Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to a new episode of the New Books Network. My name is Victor Monin, and today I have the pleasure of welcoming Annalisa Berta, Professor Emerita of Biology at San Diego State University, to talk about a book she co-authored with Professor Susan Turner, Honorary Research Fellow at the Department of Geosciences at the Queensland Museum in Australia. And the book in question is Rebels, Scholars, Explorers, Women in Vertebrate Paleontology, which retraces the multiple contributions made by women in vertebrate paleontology since the 18th century until today. So, Professor, thank you so much for joining me today. And before we start delving into the book, I always like to go back to the origin of the book itself. And so I would like you to, if you don't mind, share with us some of the reasons and motivations behind this book on women in vertebrate paleontology, and how you came to collaborate with Professor Susan Turner as well on this project.
Sure, Victor. I had just retired from San Diego State University, where I had been for 32 years, and it had come to my attention that there really wasn't a book about the history of women in vertebrate paleontology. And just so your readers know, vertebrate paleontology is the study of the remains of backboned animals. So this includes bones, teeth, footprints. And usually people that go into vertebrate paleontology have a familiarity or background in biology as well as geology, right? Because you find the fossils within the rock deposits. And you describe and identify those fossils, and perhaps maybe you're looking interested in the ecology or the habitat of the animals. All of those sub areas are incorporated within the field. At any rate, I had thought it would be worthwhile to document the contributions of women in the field. And of course, I had heard about a number of women, and I just decided to start researching it. And when I began researching it, I came across Susan Turner's name. She had written about women in the geosciences. So that includes, of course, paleontology as well as geology. And I thought she would make a great addition because she would have a different perspective. And also she was in Australia, so she offered even, you know, a different background and orientation than I did. So we proposed the book to Johns Hopkins Press, and this was back in 2018, I believe. And they were very enthusiastic about the book. And then at the annual meeting, we have every year a meeting of vertebrate paleontologists, the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology, which is the largest, you know, worldwide organization of paleontologists. It includes probably 2,400 paleontologists. In any case, we decided to interview about 18 women. And so we produced a series of videos that you can get on YouTube about these women. And we also incorporated them in the book itself, which the book sort of begins with an introduction to the field and then talks a little about different paleontologic organizations and the role of women in these groups. And then it looks chronologically at the contributions of women from the 18th century to now. And then at the very last chapter discusses some of the challenges that women have faced, challenges regarding pay and equity, conducting work in the field, harassment issues, all these sorts of things, and how women have overcome these challenges and gone on to be successful in the field. And we really wanted this to be something we would pass on to future generations so they knew about our history as a organization.
I feel like you started with this remark that apart from this book, that you published with Susan Turner, that there really isn't any other broad overview of the place of women in vertebrate paleontology. There are some biographies of very famous figures like Mary Anning, for example. But when you think about in general the traditional history of paleontology has obviously been focusing mainly on men, and there are a lot of heroic male figures in vertebrate paleontology, like Georges Cuvier, William Buckland, Richard Hoehn, George Simpson, etc. So, and even today, the vertebrate paleontologists that usually appear in the press are most often men. And I suspect it proved extremely challenging maybe to gather information about these women in vertebrate paleontology. So could you maybe give us a sense of how that research process went through? I mean, your book presents so many different women, but also what we get to see, and what's very interesting, I think, while reading the book, is that we're seeing a whole lot of new information, but also we're seeing a lot of gaps in those biographies that you're trying to reconstruct. Sometimes we don't even know the dates of birth, or there's also a very interesting aspect of the book, which is both its richness of new information, but also the information that is still not there, that remains to be recovered. So could you give us a sense of, what was your fact-gathering process with Susan Turner?
It was really quite challenging. I mean, there have been a lot of articles about British vertebrate paleontologists. So we were able to reference articles describing their contributions. And then, you know, there have been various books talking about women in science. And so we knew we had that background as well. And you're right. It was very much a male dominated field, and women were always present, but they were present in a background role. At the time, you know, many women early on were not university educated. So they were collectors of fossils. They were artists. And then they would bring them to their husbands or their male colleagues who would describe, you know, scientifically describe the material, and then it would get published. But the women were not even acknowledged for their contributions. Although, as I said, they especially Mary Anning, perhaps the best known of these very early British vertebrate paleontologists. She made amazing discoveries, and she and her mother actually, to get extra money, sold fossils, and they were purchased by different individuals at the time and turned over to museums and things. But, women were kind of in the background for a very long time, and they continued to make discoveries and things as time went on. As they became university educated and their contributions became recognized, especially, you know, in the 19th century. Now, the society itself formed in the 1940s. And from that point, you know, early on, there were very few women, you know, presenting papers at the meeting. And then gradually that number has increased, although still today there, you know, when you look around, there are not that many women in the field. It's increasing, but I guess that's what I would say. The increase in number of women has been slow. It's increased more more rapidly, you know, in the last 10 years. But before that, it was just kind of a very slow increase.
So how did the search come about in terms of information? Did you locate specific archives that proved to be very wealthy in information, or was it also a lot about? It seemed to be that maybe a lot of these information maybe came from just meeting people who had the same interests as you and Susan Turner, maybe, and giving you new insights on the whole. I've heard about maybe this woman who contributed in the field in such way, and this led to new leads. I'm really interested in how that came about, how this gathering of information came about.
Some of these women, there had been a little bit written about them. They had published papers and things. So we could actually do, you know, searches on them and discover their... Also, I spent several weeks at the Smithsonian, Washington, D.C., because that's where the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology has archives. And so I spent time going through the archives, and I was able to research women that were members of the society. And I could, you know, I could, with that, I could go back to the 1940s. And some of these women were, several of the women were presidents of the society. So there was correspondence back and forth. I could read letters. So I was at least able to do that. And Susan Turner had a background where, and information about many of the, she's a fish paleontologist. And as it turns out, many of the women that were interested in fish paleontology were from China and also from Russia. And so she had already looked into had the names of women that we could, you know, find out more information about.
I see. And so what a feature that's interesting about the book is that it's obviously a series of all sorts of biographies of, also it's this series is organized though chronologically, and I think you're trying to also provide a sort of a framework to historically understand the progression and the evolution of the place of women in vertebrate paleontology. Would you mind maybe like giving us a sense of what are the major steps or how you've organized chronologically these biographies? What were the turning points?
As I mentioned before, women started out in the 18th century, and the earliest women were collecting fossils or they were artists. And then from there, you know, there became women that once they became educated, they specialized in doing research or in some cases teaching or both. And then a little bit later, there were quite a bit later in the 1970s, there were women that were hired for being outreach educators, right? So they would work at trying to get, this was back when, you know, there was these debates about creationism and evolution and that sort of thing. And that, so paleontology kind of was the science that really addressed, you know, evolution. And so there were more museums began hiring outreach educators to tell the public about the importance and the significance of evolution and paleontology. So that sort of specialization developed, you know, rather late as we became more and more interested in, you know, the public understanding of evolution. But along the way, there were also, you know, as these fossils were collected, let's say the 18th century, more, this is when this became popular, there were women that were in charge of curating collections of fossils. And so, you know, the role of curators was another opportunity for women to be involved in the field. So you had research, teaching, curation, you know, outreach educators, all of these sort of sub-disciplines within the field.
I think to me, this is also an aspect of the book that I really appreciated, because when we think about paleontology in general, we have mainly the idea of paleontologists going out in the field. Maybe some people might also think about what goes on in laboratories after fossils are being collected. But they're rarely the sense that there's actually a whole universe of different kind of professions that are contributing to communicating the knowledge to the public, preparing the fossils themselves as specimens. And so there are all these supporting roles. It's an expression that you use in your book as well, like technicians, educators, managers of collections, etc., and paleo artists as well. So what I thought very interesting is that by taking this approach of asking what is the contribution of women in vertebrate paleontology, it helps us discover a whole universe of connected professions around vertebrate paleontology. So
yeah, it's very diverse. There's many different areas of interest. And that was the thing in the beginning, I was really going to, I had thought we would focus on researchers, you know, women in the field that were focused on different research questions. And then it became very clear that if we really wanted a more complete picture of the contributions of these women, we needed to look at some of these other supporting roles, as you say, as artists or preparators or outreach educators and so forth. And there, we really were able to, uncover quite a lot of other women in that way.
Has this process, you mentioned that you, at first you thought you were going to focus on researchers only, but has this process changed your own perception of your field? I know that you already had quite an extended experience, but has this historical research also helped you and some of your colleagues maybe that were involved change their perspective of their field in general?
Yeah, it just adds a richness to it that I wasn't as aware of, I will say. I mean, of course, when you go to the meetings and you see, you know, we have an artist group or a preparator group and so forth. So I knew that there were these other areas, but I hadn't really explored some of these occupations that have really are instrumental. You know, obviously you don't have, you can't really write a paper about a specimen if it's not been well prepared or well illustrated. So all of these, you know, really they work hand in hand. These artists and preparators work hand in hand with the researchers to bring the specimens to life, really.
I think the book also, one question I had is, obviously you mentioned that the book is very much written for any kind of audience, because it also provides an understanding. It has an introduction explaining just the history of the field in general, what it entails. So it's very much geared also toward a general public audience. But I feel like there is also a very specific goal behind this book, very practical, which is to educate, I feel, also the paleontological community in particular. And I feel there's also passages in the book that are directly addressed to women preparing or starting a career in the field of vertebrate paleontology. So what was your targeted audience when you were preparing the book? Who did you hope the book would touch?
Yeah, I guess future generations that were interested not just in vertebrate paleontology per se, but interested in science in general, because many of the challenges that women have encountered and overcome, it's not just, they're not unique to vertebrate paleontology, right? Other women in science have, you know, there's issues about going out into the field, harassment issues, pay equity issues, all of these sorts of things have confronted lots of different scientific disciplines, not just vertebrate paleontology. So I guess I feel like if you know more about your history and you can share experiences, it puts you in better stead for, when you encounter this, you realize that others have gone through some of these same challenges and have overcome them and gone on to persist and to do really great work in the field. It's not like you're all alone. The society itself has now become very welcoming and encourages the work of younger scientists. And so it's a very, it's very worthwhile endeavor.
Do you feel like the paleontological community in general is seeking these new history of its own discipline, right? Because there's already a very entrenched tradition of as we mentioned, a very tradition of how this field came about and its different heroes. But do you feel like has been a good reception of those new narratives?
Yes, very much so. And there also have been other books that have come out that are geared more toward younger girls, getting them interested in science and in particular invertebrate paleontology. So they're written, you know, more like a graphic novel type of book. So again, it's appealing to young girls and women at various ages to try to be as encouraging as possible about the field.
I see. Did you encounter what kind of? I mean, there's so many stories in that book, and I think that's really the beauty of it. Every time you could just open a page at any page of the book and just read one or two biographies and really be blown away sometimes by the kind of difficulties that some of these women managed to go through, or just their imagination or ingenuity as well in contributing to the field. Are there maybe one or two stories that particularly, struck you when you uncovered them?
Well, one was a Polish scientist by the name of Sofia Kielan-Jaworowska. And she was living in Poland at the time of the Nazi regime. So when she was studying, she was not studying in school because the Nazis had taken over the town that she was in, which she was living in Poland. And she and a few others were meeting sort of in secret at different apartments. And years later, she went on to do very extensive fieldwork in Mongolia and lead these joint expeditions for research in the Gobi Desert and make lots of wonderful discoveries of dinosaurs and mammals and things. And so she had, this whole very difficult childhood and background where she was trying to get, really to get training in the field and had to do it, under a lot of stress, really. So that's one story.
And it tells a lot about the book itself, I think, because these stories are not just for filling gaps in our history of vertebrate paleontology, but they're also kind of little inspirational vignettes for maybe the reader who is encountering, maybe difficulties or trouble in accessing a career in vertebrate paleontology.
Another one is a scientist who is in South Africa, Anyusa Sinchami Taran. And she explains that, being a woman was not nearly as difficult as trying to do field work in South Africa. She had great difficulty and she couldn't ride certain buses. She couldn't go to her field area because of apartheid at that time in the 70s. And so, you read about all these, it sort of makes it, hopefully what we wanted women to get out of this is despite all of these challenges, these women persisted and managed to continue in the field. And one of the things is at the end of the book, we provide some recommendations for things, when you encounter obstacles, how do you get around them? And how do you make sure that you have somebody tells you you can't do it and you really are passionate about going into this field and you really want to do it. You have to find yourself, surround yourself with people that are encouraging you, not people that are negative telling you shouldn't be doing this. So it's, we were also able to get into that part of the book as well to encourage people to pursue it as a field of science.
I thought the book in this sense was extremely generous, obviously, once again, not just in terms of new historical information, but also in advice. And I think there's a very beautiful feature of the book that I particularly like is are all these quotes and answers to questions from current women in the field. Could you maybe tell us a bit more? You mentioned already that you interviewed about 18 or more women. Can you maybe tell us a bit how this this process of getting these interviews done went through? What kind of reception you got from the people you interviewed?
Right. Well, we asked them about their own experiences, and a number of women, of course, are married. And you know, how did you deal with leaving your kids and going into the field? And several of the women, Jaylen Eberle and at Colorado Museum, and Christy Curry Rogers at McAllister University in Minnesota. Both of them have had children, small children, and they did extensive field work. And they finally just decided it made a lot of sense to just bring their kids into the field. And at least that way, their graduate students could see that they could still, you know, work and have their children nearby, and you know, they could be successful. They didn't need to worry about, you know, farming their children out somewhere. So, and I think as they both said in the interview, that it was very rewarding to their graduate students to actually see that they could be successful and have their kids in the field as well.
So yeah, I think one of the main difficulties, obviously, is family, the work. Like for a very long time, and even still today, women have been usually forced out of their career because of motherhood. So there's been this idea that there's a sort of incompatibility between a scientific career and becoming a mother. This is one of the main challenges. But could you give us maybe an idea of what kind of other specific challenges women are still confronted with?
This is a personal story. My own entry into the field. This was back. I was a graduate student at Berkeley, and I went to Berkeley. I had a background in geology. I was well acquainted with field work. And when I got to Berkeley, I found out that my advisor did not take women in the field. So that was kind of a big blow. And I thought, well, why am I going to continue this? I can't go and collect fossils. And there was another, you know, this is where you learn a lot from your fellow graduate students. One of my fellow students that was in the same lab I was in just suggested that maybe since I wasn't going to be able to go into the field, maybe I should work with a collection. And so that kind of sent me off in another direction entirely, where I was working with material that had already been collected in museums. And that's, I later went into the field, you know, years later. But at that point, I had to make a decision. Since I'd come to graduate school, if I wasn't going to be allowed to collect the fossils, I was going to have to work with material that was already collected. And so I actually went down to South America, worked at several collections on material in collections in Argentina. But it really changed the whole course of my career, because from then on, I really focused on material that had already been collected. I didn't do collections because of this experience that I had, where my advisor, just didn't take women in the field. Why did he? I always often get asked, well, why didn't he take women in the field? I think he thought they were just going to be, you know, there would possibly be a distraction, too difficult to deal with us in the, you know, take us out to the field. We have different, I guess they thought just would be a problem. It wouldn't work out.
So these reasons weren't even explicit.
Right. No.
This is very interesting to also, and I think this is why the book to me had this very interesting aspect of mentoring. And I feel like at least while reading the book, it felt like a book that was meant to also mentor future.
Again, by sharing experiences, you tell your colleagues and other women that yes, it is possible to be successful. These are just, you know, temporary roadblocks that you encounter, individuals' ideas that maybe you can't do something for whatever reason, and you can overcome those. And then now there are, you know, that sort of thing wouldn't be an issue. Although there are women in other fields of science, you maybe have read about the women that were doing research in Antarctica and have had various harassment issues that have developed. And so it's still, you know, it still can be a challenge to go into the field.
One other aspect of the book that I want to talk about a little is, and I really appreciated it because it reminds me of actually a project that you both mentioned in the book, which is the Bearded Lady Project, which is a project involving the photographs of women in paleontology in the field and wearing fake beards, and was sort of a commentary on the gender biases in the field that have existed. But I thought one of the interesting features of the book are the photographs that you've added in the middle of the volume. And I thought that was absolutely fantastic because, once again, we don't get to see a lot of women in the field, and especially women from the 19th century or early 20th century working in the lab. And I think there's one, my favorite of these photographs is the one showing Carrie Barbour, who is cleaning out some of the matrix around a beautiful Apatosaurus, I think, femur. And I think it's a beautiful picture because the bone is so massive. And the work that she's carrying seems both extremely technical, but also physical. And once again, this is the kind of things that we are not used to see. And I think because we don't see these images, it feeds on this idea that any work that is physical, any work that deals with the field, is not quote unquote feminine. So how important was it for you to uncover those images, and maybe what is one of your favorites?
The one you mentioned is really quite. Carrie Barbour was a paleontologist in Nebraska, and she was associated with the university and with the museum for many years, the early 1900s. And she also did a lot of field collecting with her brother, who was a well-known paleontologist. Just uncovering those. I mean, there were just, you try to get photographs and things of women, cleaning, preparing fossils, drawing specimens, that kind of thing. And in some cases, we could find, great photographs, like you mentioned, in newspaper articles, that kind of thing. But there still are a lot that are probably that we, haven't uncovered that are in, like I said, smaller printing places and things.
Yeah, and this leads me to my final question, really, because obviously I feel like uncovering the history of all these women in vertebrate paleontology seems like a never-ending project, because there's always going to be a woman that we are still not aware of the contribution because she was named as an author for papers, for example, or was working in the shadow of an uncle or a brother or a father. What is, obviously the book marks a very important milestone, I think, in this research, but what is the next step for you, maybe, and Susan Turner in this project? What are you particularly looking forward to?
Well, I'd like to perhaps write more extended biographies of just a few women, and maybe organize it a little bit differently. Maybe organize it according to subfield of paleontology, like research and teaching, and just take a few women and delve into their histories a little bit more. The other thing I think is really important is if we're going to be able to really reach out to younger generations, I think we need to do more with podcasts, perhaps, and interviewing, because really that's, the written word is important, but there also are lots of other media that are, that others, especially social media, that younger generations look at. And I think these interviews could have really lasting importance.
Yeah, I think, and I think that's one of the feature of the book as well, is that I mean, we talked about obviously the photographs, but there's also a very interesting approach, data driven approach. I think how important, maybe if we can end on this, how important was it for you to not just have this biographical approach to the contribution of these women, but really also provide the data?
Well, that was very important, but that's the part that you know, we don't, much of the data was really came from the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology, from the membership records and things, and so we have a pretty good handle on what happened here within that society. But societies in other countries, for example, we didn't have access to their data. There are many, they were, you know, in terms of looking at number of women and the contributions, they were smaller numbers of women, but we couldn't really, you know, we didn't have that data available. The Society of Vertebrate Paleontology is, as I said, the largest organization of vertebrate paleontologists. It is an international organization, but still within, as we point out in the beginning of the book, there are lots of other societies that are regional or national to a particular country. So we didn't, and they're much smaller. So we didn't have, we weren't really able to add that data in. So it was, you know, hopefully we even, you know, by publishing our book and publishing information about when women got into, interested in various groups, hopefully we can, that'll encourage other societies to collect that data as well, and to share it.
Well, thank you so much for having shared all of these insights on the book. And I'm really looking forward to future material connected to the book, like podcast eventually,
any other medium. What other directions, you know, what other different kinds of media we could bring to the fore.
No, I think this would be fantastic. And I think the book, once again, like, could provide this this foundation for then future projects that would appeal to a diverse audience. But again, thank you so much, Professor, for having joined me today.
You're welcome.